Good. We're going to jump back onto number 7. Does everybody have a copy of number 7 with them? If not, I can give you one here. Just to maybe add like two little sections to wrap up there. And we need a 7.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's
a 7.
All right. Yep. All right, so we're on page 4 of 7. And we had kind of left it, at a rather dramatic point, right? We left just at the peak of Jesus' passion, death, and resurrection on Mount Calvary. And if I remember right, we had just finished his passion and death. Does that sound right? Or maybe the covenant part? No, the passion and death, right? So we left off, you know, with him. You know, we were talking about, like, what it would look like actually to be, you know, there. Like, you would put them on the small beam and put them up on the steepest, the sharp posts and stuff like that. And then while he's hanging there, then in the midst of that, the church leaves us with 7, what they call the 7 last words of Christ. Really 7 last sentences or 7 last sayings. But the traditional line is the 7 last words of Christ. And so I want to very briefly touch on this. But the thing to remember is that, as I described last time, you know, the body is stretched and put up there. That, you know, we think of it like, oh, he's bleeding death. Well, again, Jesus had a unique situation where you would never have been scourged before being crucified. They would be putting two punishments together, which went against each other. Scourging would make you weak, whereas what they wanted you strong when you were broken on the cross to drag this out, to be these billboards. Excuse me. These billboards of Roman imperialism. So that's why they left them, you know, whole, you know, so they could hang there for 2 or 3 days and stuff like that. So Jesus' unique situation, but all of them would have suffered the same problem of, as you're hanging there, you have to make this choice, right? As you hang, eventually the weight begins to pull down, your arms and shoulders, your chest begin to tighten up, the muscles begin to contract, especially if you've lost a lot of sweat, and they, you know, start to kind of go into spasms and stuff like that, and that's to tighten, then you can't breathe. You know, if you ever, like, remember, like, when you're hanging on the, you know, the chin-up bar in school, it's really hard to breathe when you got your arms, like, so that's where you're like, you have to go fast because you're getting tireder by the second and your breath is getting harder. And as that's happening, then you have to make the decision to catch your breath as it starts to, basically, you start to slowly asphyxiate. And so you push up with your foot on the bottom nail and you pull up with your hands against these nails to pull yourself up. But, of course, what you're doing then is the nerve that has been pierced by these nails is being wrapped around that metal and stretched like a piano wire, like taut, and the pain shoots up and down your arms then and through your feet as well. So just to be able to catch your breath is incredibly excruciating pain. You pull yourself up as long as you can, catch your breath until the pain comes too much, sag back down, give yourself a break from that. And so this seesaw battle of breathing in pain or slumping and drowning in your own breath is basically the battle that they fight on the cross. And, you know, people have, you know, talked about, you know, what it's like in, you know, breathing diseases, say that, you know, they can't imagine, you know, that sort of thing, but you realize that really is what happens to them for hours, days, years on end in those sort of things, trying to always catch your breath and not being able to do that. So in all that, it makes his words all the more poignant because we say, wow, he had to, you know, work pretty darn hard to get those words out. They must be pretty important for us. So I'm going to just run through them very quickly. The first one is, I'm going to not always write them all out. The Father, forgive them. The full line being, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. The first thing Jesus does as they're putting the nails in his hands is to forgive those around him. All right? The next one is when he turns, when the other thief, when the good thief stands up for Jesus against the bad thief, and he says, you know, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus says, you will be with me. In paradise. Promises eternal life to the good thief. All right. Then he turns to his mother and to the beloved disciple, and he says, "Woman, behold your son." And then next, he quotes from Psalm 22, which we actually had as our psalm last week, which was the "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" This marker is about done. And there is both a certain literal meaning in that, you know, he, at that moment in his humanity, as we discussed, his humanity, this is the moment where he feels most separate, most in doubt, most in fear, but also he's quoting, that's really hard to read, isn't it? Why have you? But he's also quoting Psalm 22, which is both this prophetic psalm about him being attacked, ringed around by enemies. They taunt him. They say, let God save him. His hands and his feet are torn. His mouth is parched. He can't breathe. His heart melts away like wax. All these descriptions in Psalm 22 that, of course, are fulfilled in a very real way on the cross. Even like you know, they divide my garments and you know, cast lots for them. All those sort of things. All right. Next, I thirst. Says, it is finished. It's interesting. He says, I thirst, and they bring him, they take this sponge and dip it in common wine and put it on a stick and put it up there for him to take a sip of. Remember I told you last week that at the Passover, there's four cups of wine, or is it a Passover? The third cup is the one that he uses to say, you take this, all of you, and drink of it. And we said he never tells us of drinking the fourth cup. Except for here, he takes a drink of wine on that sponge, and then he says, it is finished. The Greek here is more than just it's finished. It's sometimes translated, it is accomplished, it is consummated, it is completed. So many scripture scholars read this, the entire thing from Thursday night until Friday 3 p.m. is his Passover, right? He drinks three cups, and then he drinks the fourth drink right there on the cross, and says, it is finished, it is done, I've completed it, it's consummated, it's completed. So there is the ultimate Passover. Remember we said, just as the moment the lambs are having their throats slit in the temple precincts and being poured out, you know, for the Passover, a celebration that evening, all of this is happening there, in front of them, but it's also happening at Jesus on the cross. And then finally he says, into your hands, I commend my spirit. And then it says he breathed his last. What's interesting to know about, that line there, it fits well with our idea of that final surrender. He's saying, okay, Father, I let myself go. I let myself fall. You know, you catch me. I'm in faith, I say, I can't do anything else. I commend myself entirely to you. All right? So we have that. All right, so that, and then finally, his death, I really kind of explained most of it already in terms of the fighting back and forth. Eventually, you know, that pressure would build up. You would be so exhausted you wouldn't be able to pull yourself up anymore. You'd basically choke on your own breath and asphyxiate. There is evidence that maybe that even could cause a heart attack, and that's why it could happen so quickly. There's speculation that when the spear then pierces his side and the blood and water flow out, there's doctors who even say that would be a sign of great distress, that the... Trisha, you're the medical person here. Is it the pericardial sac? Is that something? It's the area around the heart. And like apparently that can really fill up with fluid during this struggle we described. And that sword then piercing that would open that up. And so out would come the fluid and then the blood. So sounds legit. Yeah, I'm buying it. And that there's kind of a sign. There's even some medical information going on that. But of course, we find a spiritual meaning in that as well. One of the church fathers, I think it's Augustine, talks about, just as Eve was taken out of the side of Adam in the garden, so the new Adam in the new creation, the church, his wife, his bride, is born out of the side of him as it's poured out. The blood representing the Eucharist, the water representing the baptism, stuff like that. So there's a lot of spiritual thoughts on that as well. I'm going to have you jump really quick to page 5, since we are a little behind. His resurrection. If you heard me preach at all in the Easter season, I usually come back to this point, so I'm just going to do it kind of briefly here. You know, the thing that you have to ask yourself with is believable, because this is the question. Everything else can be taken care of historically. The question of, you know, who he is, what he said, what he claimed, how he died, is part of the historical record. When you start asking, did he rise from the dead, that's a question of faith. But the problem is people all too often leave it as just a thing of faith, as if the same way... You know, that a little kid says, I believe in unicorns. As if that is the same kind of faith going on here. And I would argue that it shouldn't be. If our belief in Jesus' resurrection is on the same level as, you know, people who, like, just, you know, believe in magic or hobbits or dragons or whatever, then faith is a pretty weak sort of thing. The way you got to think about faith, in my opinion, is picture it as a bridge. So here's my little river going by. So I've got these two sides of my two banks right now. I've never been to Australia, but I believe in Australia. Why do I believe in Australia? Because there is a lot of believable evidence pointing to it. It seems like every map has it, every history book talks it. I've had friends who said they've been to Australia, so maybe they got, like, you know, just driven off to California and, you know, spent 20 hours flying around and then landed back in a different part of California. Maybe, you know, that happened, but they said people talk different, act different, blah, blah, blah. It sure seems like Australia is a real thing. So that the leap of faith for me to believe in Australia is pretty small. There's a lot of other evidence before having to make that leap, and I feel pretty confident that Australia is a thing, right? But we do it all the time. It's funny, you know, you ask people, what's the fifth planet? They're like, oh, it's Jupiter, right? Well, okay, but do you really know that? Do you really know it's the fifth one in order? I mean, we maybe have seen it on a magazine. If we were lucky, we've seen it in an observatory? What's that?
Planetarium,
exactly, right? You know, but even then, you're still trusting that somebody else has done the math to figure out what the order of these guys is, right? You know, so we're trusting on a lot of stuff. We do a whole lot of that. The question is with the resurrection is it a leap from one bank to the other? Is it a leap like this? Is it somewhere in between? And you've probably heard me then, you know, on Easter Sunday talk about, like, you know, at the end of the day, yes, it is unbelievable to think that a man died and rose again. My grandma's dead, my grandpa and other relatives are dead, you know, and they're not coming back, and I have no reason to think they're coming back. People will come back from the dead. That's unbelievable. On the other hand, the only reason to believe it is that the only other alternative is even more unbelievable. And that's to say that these men, these scared 11 men, who the two nights before had run away when threatened with the slightest bit of persecution by the Roman guards, the guys who wouldn't even show up at the crucifixion for fear that they were going to get, you know, killed too, the guys who hunkered down and hid in this upper room in Jerusalem, that these guys somehow, in the afternoon of Saturday, between Good Friday and what we call Easter Sunday, that one of them, as they're sitting around this circle, depressed, crushed, their leader, their friend, their master is gone, one of them sits there and goes, guys, come here, I got it. Listen, I got a plan. Okay, here's what I do. Okay, all right. You know how Jesus, who we thought was the Messiah, just got killed brutally yesterday? You know how our hopes and dreams are destroyed by that? I know, it's really sad, but here's what we do. Rather than just admit defeat and go back to our fishing and our farming and stuff like that, tonight. Let's just tonight. We'll sneak out to the tomb, and we'll get past the Roman soldiers. I know they're big and fierce, and if they fall asleep on the job, they'll get killed for it. But I'm sure we'll find them napping. We'll get past them. We'll grab the body out of the tomb. We'll sneak back, throw it in the town dump, and then tomorrow morning, on Easter Sunday morning, we'll run through town, and be like, "He's alive! He's alive!" They're like, "Who? Jesus? What? I saw him killed. I know, but he's back from the dead. He's resurrected. Like, wow! Can we see him?" No, he only appears to us, and rather infrequently, and he walks through the walls, and we never know when he's going to come. Okay, well, if you see him, let me know if I can. I'm like, you betcha, kid, right? We go off, and we'll hang out for a while, and then later on, we go out again and say, like, he's alive, he told us about it, he's given us a message. We're like, can we see him? Like, no, he ascended. What's that mean? It means he took off into the sky and won't be back to the end of the world. And then we'll go around, and we'll preach the gospel, and we'll get kicked out of our families and rejected by the synagogues, and eventually the Romans will hate us too, and the Greeks, and we'll be hunted by all people, we'll be persecuted, eventually we'll be rewarded with death. All right, who's in? Right? I mean, that's what you would have to explain. That's the only other possibility, because, you know, if there's one thing every Jew knew, it's that the Messiah's job is to win. What makes you Messiah is that you win, that you conquer, that you bring back David's kingdom. If you got killed by the Romans on the third year of your, like, you know, your teaching mission, you can't be the Messiah. They would have gone home, they would have looked for another Messiah, they would have tried to join another zealot group, they would not have looked for, you know, this guy to come back. They would have had no reason to think to invent this, to make this up. Every reference to resurrection in the Old Testament, when you look at it, yeah, there's prophecy in there, but it does not look nearly as convincing of what we think it is as when we look back. We look back and we're like, oh, Psalm 30, it talks about how you rise from the dead. Yeah, but it talks about rising from the dead in other parts of the scripture, meaning like I was defeated in battle and I came back, you know, and won again against my enemies. I was, you know, impoverished, and I came back and was successful. I was brokenhearted, and God lifted me and gave me joy. Like, there is not a lot of description of resurrection. If there is in the Old Testament, it's the idea that the whole people at the end of time will be resurrected to judgment, kind of like we saw on Sunday's readings. But there is not a description of one individual person getting up out of the grave a couple days after he was buried. You do not find that. So they had no reason to expect that. The only way to explain what happened on that day is that they actually saw him. The one that they had seen killed had come back and was convincingly there in front of them. And people, you know, will push this and say, well, I don't know, the apostles, you know, like, you know, they went around, they spread all this stuff. Like, how do you know that they're believing them? Like, because you know what? They were persecuted unto death, and nobody dies for what they know they made up, right? If I asked you guys, would you, you know, take a bullet for Santa Claus, for the Easter Bunny, for the Tooth Fairy? Heck no, right? You know, it's hard enough to die for the God you really truly believe in, let alone made up things, right? People will die for crazy things. We know that. You know, people died, you know, suicide bombers just last weekend. You know, people will die for the religious ideas, but nobody dies for a thing that they know they made up, right? And that's the essential difference. Like, even if, like, a few people got excited and they got kind of crazy, maybe a little, you know, delusional or whatever, there's 11 of them, or actually 12 eventually, and Matthias joins them. You know, you'd think at, like, the 30-year apostle reunion, by then somebody would have, like, you know, broken, right? You know, be like, guys, I'm tired. I've been running around the world. You know, it's been kind of fun telling everybody the story. The book's selling great, you know, but, like, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go home to my family. I want to retire in the synagogue. I want to, you know, settle down. We all know we made that up. Let's just give it up and go home and just be okay. Nobody did that. Every last one of those apostles died for that faith. And that tells us that that is a believable kind of thing. And that yes, it's incredible to think that a man rose from the dead, but it's even more incredible to think that 12 men would die having lied about a story they know they made up. Anyway, you can go on and on that. You can, I can go on. We'll do that. But okay, finally, go ahead. It would be like, so Hanukkah is their feast of lights. It celebrates the rededication of the Jewish temple. I'm trying to think, we have the book of Maccabees, on weekdays we have it, I'm not sure on Sunday. Maccabees is the story about 150 years before Jesus was born. The Greeks had persecuted the Jews and took away their temple. And then when the Maccabees, which is a family, when they fought back and got that back, they have... they celebrate it by having this festival of lights, and that's what Hanukkah is. I think what happened is Christmas was such a big thing in Europe and in America that they kind of grabbed a hold of the closest holiday and kind of made it Christmassy. I don't think, like, if you did Hanukkah back in, like, 1000 AD, if the Jews would have really done it like we do, like presents and stuff, but I think it's kind of a way of making a Jewishy Christmas stuff. But yeah, so that's why the Jews, you know, would say, like, no, we don't believe that because we don't believe that he really was the Messiah. We don't believe he really rose from the dead. All right? Completing the Paschal mystery, the key here is just to understand that, like, if we had just left it at his giving us his flesh and blood at the Last Supper, or just left it at his dying on the cross, then you'd be left with just a tragedy. You'd be left with a great sacrifice, a beautiful sacrifice, but there's something more that has to be accomplished there. As I think it was Bishop Ruskowitz said the first time I heard it, Good Friday without Easter Sunday is a tragedy, but Easter Sunday without Good Friday is a farce. You need both of them. And so it completes the thing. The lamb that was sacrificed has now been given life again. The one who had died has been resurrected. And all the things that seemed broken in Good Friday are now re-put together in that. And we talked about the Passover, you know, being, you know, yes, the Passover from, you know, the angel of death passing over their houses right in Egypt. Right, there's my little house and there's my little angel. Doesn't he look fierce? He's got a little sword, right? Right, the angel looks like a duck. The angel of death passed over the houses back then, but also the idea of them passing over the Red Sea. I can't even draw the Red Sea if I won't. But in the New Testament, there's also this sense of, yes, death passed over us by Jesus dying on the cross, but also we pass over from death into new life. So there's kind of the fulfillment of all those things of Passover. And also, we'll talk more about this Eucharist, the idea that, like, you know, if it's just his body and blood and the sacrifice of the cross, that's great, but his resurrection means that that gift of himself now has new life in it. So again, we'll talk more about that at the Eucharist, though. The liturgy and liturgical year. I'm already at halfway time. I think I'm just going to have to recognize that I'm not going to get the church done today. I'll just get started. Okay, so Then I'll just spread out one more week and we'll actually catch up. See? We can make good out of bad. Actually, you'll notice that the date is totally off here. Apparently, last time I did this one was December 9th, 2010. So, on the one number eight. So, anyway. So, actually, we're ahead of schedule. But liturgy and liturgical year. Then, with this whole Paschal mystery, the way in which the church year works then, we're used to the idea, you know, that... what is the center of the entire liturgical year? What is the high point of the entire church year? The one day that's at the peak of everything. Absolute peak. Biggest day in the church year. Easter Sunday, right? So the absolute peak of everything is Easter Sunday. So I'm going to draw... How do I do this? Do I have colors? Yeah, I got enough colors. I got lots of colors, all right? So my absolute peak is... I'm going to go big, huge asterisk here, all right? Easter Sunday is my peak. All right. I'm trying to think how much room we have here. Yes. Okay. So it says temporal. So I'm going to explain that just in a little bit. So put this kind of up high, or actually, you know, you can put this in the middle. You can put this under Paschal seasons if you have room, if you want. There's enough room there. There's fine. So Easter season is the peak. What is the season that comes before Easter, leading up to it? 40 days.
Lent.
Okay, good. So we've got our season leading up to it. I go like this. So I've got Lent. And then we actually call the time after Easter Sunday the Easter season for 50 days going this way. All right? I made a mess of that. Let's push it back a little.
What do you call that?
Just the Easter season. So we have Easter Sunday, and then we have the Easter season. And notice what we have here is we have Lent 40 days ahead, Easter 50 days after. If you want, I can even label the days and stuff here. So 40 of Lent, 50 of Easter. And we should make special note of before Easter... We should put in here, it's going to be hard to fit, but I'm putting Good Friday. Because literally, all of Lent is moving towards Good Friday, and then all of Easter is flowing out of Easter. And so the 3 days, Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter Sunday, and then Holy Saturday in between, that really forms the core, the very center, where the biggest, you know, the Jews talk about their high holy days, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and stuff like that. These are our high holy days. Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday somewhat, and then Easter Sunday. You know, Holy Saturday is kind of weird because it's a day there, but it's not even a full day, right? I mean, like, you know, it's, yeah, because you even do the Easter Vigil the night before. But on that day, it's weird because you can't do anything. Like, literally, like, there's, you know, I always joke, like, okay, we're supposed to rise with Jesus on Easter, we're supposed to suffer and die with Jesus on Good Friday. So what do you do on Holy Saturday? Take a nap. Sleep in. Rest and relax, right? Jesus is resting in the tomb. You rest also, right? You've had a good hard Lent. You put it all in for 40 days. Now, you know, rest up to be able to celebrate on the other end, right? So you got this going on here, all right? Now, I'm going to go ahead and continue on this. Below, I put the Christmas seasons, but I'm going to kind of work this into my picture, and then we'll explain. We'll find room for everything eventually. Do I have a dark green? I have the dark green, so I got rid of because it stank. All right. Before Lent, there is a little bit of ordinary time. Ordinary time is always green. I'll explain that here in a little bit. So we have that little bit of ordinary time there. And then before that, we have... What do I got here? I'm going to make two more. So these are the Paschal seasons. Lent and Easter, because they surround the Paschal mystery. Those are the Paschal seasons, one that you have there. Backing up here a little bit, how do I get to Easter? I got to get Jesus born. So what's the season where Jesus is born? Okay, the two of them together. Those are both right because those are the. It says the two. What did I say? Christmas seasons. Yeah, because there's really two. There is Christmas season itself. I'm going to make it blue for my sake, and then the season before it is Advent, which is also purple. So, are you confused by my color coding yet? So, I'm going to go ahead. Put Christmas. And before that, I'm going to put down here because I don't have the room, Advent. With, of course, the middle of that then is Christmas Day. Same sort of thing where the two meet. Everything up to midnight mass is Advent. And everything afterwards is the Christmas season. The same way everything up to the Easter vigil is Lent. And everything after is the Easter season. So I've got these two kind of core seasons. I've got my highest, holiest day, Easter, and my second highest day, Christmas Day, which I have no way to write in here. Christmas Day.
Ooh, Tisk, you're right next,
Miss. Okay, and actually, I'm glad you said it because I was going to explain how that actually works. Some people like, really worry about that. Like, oh, you're like, you know, taking that, you just put an X there. You should know that actually it's not an X, it's a chi. Rho, iota, sigma, tau, omicron, sigma. Christos. Christos. All right? You know how, like, at church we have that symbol, though usually we don't see it that way. Usually we see it drawn like this. That's the key rho. It's the chi, the ch sound, and the thing that looks like a p is actually an r. So it's CA. It's not XP like we're old Microsoft stuff here. It's CHR. It's the standard abbreviation for Christ's name in Greek. All right. And what you'll find is like you go look through the writings of C.S. Lewis, the letters that he writes to his friends and stuff like that. Can you guys see those? All right. Let me draw it darker. And you'll constantly see him referring to Christianity, Christology, stuff like that. Here you see him talking about the Christian era, and you'll see him either writing this or this just to refer to Jesus himself. Because before you had word processors, when you had to write everything out, it was just a heck of a lot easier to write that because people understood what you were talking about. So the idea of key and then M-A-S, meaning Christmas, is actually an incredibly old and incredibly Christian way of talking about Jesus' birthday. And in fact, you look through my notes from the seminary, and I never write out Jesus' name. There just wasn't the time when you're furiously taking notes in these hour and 15-minute classes. I mean, I had a system of abbreviations that was mind-boggling, you know? I mean, I never wrote the word church. It's always capital C-H period, right? I never wrote the names of any apostles. I never wrote the name. I mean, I had that thing down. I could write, you know, so quickly in shorthand like my own. And the easiest way to start was with, you know, that was always, you know... That was Christ, and that was Christian, and that was Christology. Write it all out that way. Easiest, you know, little thing in the world. Christendom. By the way, you do not have to write all this down. This will not be on the test. P.S. There's no test either. You know, all those sort of things written out like that. Just so you know that. Keeping Christ at Christmas is important, but worrying about the X's is not.
It's just something Sam and I always do. We don't like the X.
Yeah, and it's funny, a lot of people hear because they assume that the X was meant to take Jesus out, but they don't realize it's a very Christian thing. I remember going through the card catalog at the seminary, and you'd find written on the little cards that somebody had to type back in the day, you'd find, you know, early Xianity. You find that written out, and you're like, oh. Okay, see, this is quite normal, quite standard, et cetera, especially in, like, you know, like, the Christian academic world stuff. So we've got our two Christmas seasons, Advent, which leads up to Christmas, right? And then we've got our Paschal season of Lent, which leads up to Easter, all right? And then we should add to this, I don't have a place for it, but this, hopefully you got room around there. Then the other time, we've got green already there, but we had another green. The green is what we call ordinary time. Now, ordinary time people always assume means boring. They always assume it means, it's just ordinary. But that's not what it means. The original, it's funny. Ordinary, meaning boring, same old, nothing else going on, actually takes its name from ordinary time. So the way to understand it is, I didn't know these names until I was much older, but I think some little kids get taught them still pretty young. Do you remember the difference between the cardinal numbers and the ordinal numbers? Did you ever learn that in school? Like, I remember, I think the first time I ever heard it was actually like in French class when the teacher made the distinction between, you know, you need to learn, in French we had to learn, like, oh, so it's un, deux, trois, but, you know, that's not how you say, you know, premier, deuxième, troisième, you know, literally first, second, third. Like, oh, I get it. So 1, 2, 3, first, second, third. So cardinal numbers are your straight-up counting numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to a billion, right? You know, and then your ordinal numbers, literally the ones that put them in order. First place, second place, third place, fourth place, whatever. So ordinal means putting them in order. The official name of these weeks is not like the third Sunday in ordinary time, which we tend to put in our books. It actually is the third Sunday of the year, the 32nd Sunday of the year. What we're doing is they're the counting Sundays. There's the Sundays that are ordinal. This Sunday, that Sunday, that Sunday, counting them off. The 15th Sunday of the year, it's the 15th ordinal Sunday or the 15th ordinary. So what is ordinary time? It's the time in which you count. When you count off, there's 34 weeks of ordinary time every year. So that counts out that way. There's always a little chunk of ordinary time between Christmas and Lent. Sometimes it's 2 weeks, sometimes it's 5 weeks. But there's always a little bit there, and then you pick it up again after the Easter season ends in Pentecost. And so that's why, like, from, you know, really from June to November, it's all green, 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 green. Now, people always wonder about the green. Like, where's that come from? Is that, like, St. Patrick's Day or something like that? Is that whatever? It's funny. St. Patrick's Day can never be celebrated green. It always has to be purple. It will be purple every day from now until the end of the world because it always must fall in Lent at March 17th. Kind of funny. But the why is it green? Green is the image of growth, right? You think of, like, plants growing up and, like, the yard, and you're like, the yard grows too fast, right? But that's the image. It's stuff growing, and that's what ordinary time is about, it's a time of hunkering down and growing. There's nothing big. We're not prepping for Jesus' birth. We're not celebrating his incarnation. We're not getting ready to suffer with him on the cross. We're not celebrating the greatest, you know, amazing thing of his resurrection. We're just doing the ordinary stuff. So that's where we focus on, you know, the parables and the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus' miracles and his words and his teaching. We focus on those other things because our purpose at that point is just to continue growing and getting closer to him bit by bit as we go along. Make sense? All right. Below that, you have the sanctoral cycle. So the church, notice I have the temporal cycle. The church has two cycles running constantly. The temporal cycle is the is telling the story, tempus is time. So the temporal cycle is the timely story of what's going on. Jesus' preparation, Jesus' birth, Jesus' suffering, Jesus' resurrection. That's the temporal cycle going on. But then all along underneath it is another cycle that does things that says, like, let me think here. Oh, my mind is going blank right now.
I thought you were going to say you're having a blonde moment. It's like, no.
I guess that, yeah. I want to say it's January 7th is Agnes. And February 14th, of course, is Valentine. Though we don't celebrate him quite as big as we used to. And like I said, March 17th is Patrick. And let's see. April 25th? No. April 28th maybe is Catherine of Siena. And then you get to June. June 22nd is Thomas More. And October 1st is St. Therese. And let's see. What's another good one? I think a good saint. Well, the other day we had November 11th on. What's his name? Martin. Martin of Tours on Veterans Day. I should put St. Michael's in there. And then in middle of December, December 6th, right? December 6th is St. Patrick's, or St. Nicholas Day, right? Right? So you got all these. Now, I am cutting out 90% of all the saints here. But the idea that there's all these days along the way, and there's other ones that aren't even saint days. Like, for example, in March 25th, you have the Annunciation. Oh, you know, I miss St. Anne's Day. Annunciation. Sorry, St. Anne. Wasn't thinking there. On August 6th is the Feast of the Transfiguration. Or back here somewhere is Epiphany.
Now, Epiphany is weird. It used to be January 6th, but now it moves to the closest Sunday. So you've got these feasts of Jesus, but they're always locked on certain dates. And then you've got the Feast of the Saints. That's the sanctuary cycle. That's the part of the calendar that goes by individual days, right? So anybody know what, like, Saints' Day they're born on? Or anybody know their patron saint's feast day? That's another option. Everyone's like, nope. Well, actually, I guess really nobody has a saint name that is a particular, a first name that's a particularly well-known, like, saint day. Like, who do you celebrate, Cindy, as a patron saint? Do you have anyone that you connect with?
My confirmation
saint was Renee, but... Okay. Okay. I don't know the name or the date on that. I have no idea what the date on Saint Renee is. Trisha, what about you?
Probably Patrick.
Okay, because Patricia.
Which,
sure.
Yeah, my name's actually just Trisha, but yeah.
Okay, that's connecting that way. And then who was your confirmation saint?
Elizabeth.
Okay, all right. Like Elizabeth of Hungary?
Just Elizabeth.
All right.
Just, like, that was, yeah.
Well, happy feast day, because that's today.
Oh, well, thank
like,
you.
Like, literally today. No, November 17th, right?
Cool.
All right. Taylor, do you have a patron saint you tend to go with? Or a confirmation saint?
Well, I like to pray to Michael a lot.
Okay, so that's September 29th.
And then my confirmation was Elizabeth as well, because I was going for...
My cousin, I don't know why. Okay, all right. And there are, I think, a couple of Elizabeths, but most people, it's usually Elizabeth of Hungary. That's the story that people are most likely to know.
I think I went with
Elizabeth,
isn't that the sister?
Oh, so Elizabeth, the sister of Saint, Blessed Mary.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so if her feast is, when is her feast? I don't know. Shame on me. The visitation is May 31st, I can tell you that. So that might be the one that they tend to. And you, of course, haven't had a chance to pick a patron saint yet. But you'll get the chance, you know, in the future then. But so that idea, like this ribbon of saints' days, patron saints' day, name saints' day, birthday saints. Like, my birthday saint is Saint Romuald. Nobody knows anything about Saint Romuald, right? Whereas my name saint of Joseph on, you know, March 19th, ooh, he's a big deal, right? You know, so get to celebrate him in a big way then. So people kind of pick different, you know, saints. And some people, it has, you know, literally some people are like, well, I didn't really have a patron saint, but St. Anne's was my parish growing up, so she'll be my saint. So you get a lot of stuff, you know, on that. But that's the idea, like the calendar has overlapping things. Now, the thing that I didn't mention here is that an underlying thing of the calendar is that, okay, so the entire year swarms around Easter Sunday, right? So it's 52 weeks laid out, leading up to or flowing out of in one way or another. It's 52 weeks going towards that. The week does the same thing. And I don't have really room for this, but I think you have room on the back, right? Because there's no back page to that. In the same way, if you think about how the week works, the week is built around Sunday as the year is built around Easter. So if you put right at the center of it, Sunday. Now, I know it's confusing because Sunday, we either think of it as the first day or last day. But if you think of it in terms of, you know, the idea of it being the center, so everything is pointing towards Sunday, right? So, you know, Saturday, you know, the fact that you can, like, go to Mass on Saturday is an idea of anticipation. Friday is meant as a little Good Friday. So there's usually a sense of sacrifice in there. So, like, Fridays in Lent, you don't eat meat. And actually, we're actually called upon, even on other Fridays of the year, to kind of still make some sort of sacrifice. It doesn't have to be a sacrifice of meat, but we really are called to make some other sacrifice, you know, during the other Fridays, the exception being the Friday right after Easter Sunday, because it would be a holy day. But to kind of emphasize that. And then even before that, in some sense, just as the entire Holy Week starts with Jesus' Last Supper on Holy Thursday, his death on Good Friday, the waiting on Saturday, and then the peak on Sunday, it really does kind of move in that direction. And then, of course, then we go back to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and do our other stuff. So really, the week is built around Sunday as the year is built around Easter. And the church likes to say that every Sunday is a little Easter. That's why we make such a big deal of the church, of going to church on Sunday. Like, why is that such a big deal? Because everything hinges around that. I was going to say something. Hold on. I think I was. It hinges on Sunday. Well, crud. I don't know. There's a great line. I think the Catechism references it, but also there's the Pope Benedict gave an amazing homily
back during his pontificate about the value of Sunday. And he said, he told this story, and I forget what town the martyrs were in, but it was during the Roman persecutions. I think it was during the 200s. And in this particular town, you know, basically they came to them and said, you know, we see that you guys are great citizens. We see that you're good men and women. We like your children in our neighborhoods. We appreciate you as people. But you're not going to be able to continue to worship this Christ God that you have. And the Christian's like, eh, well, we're not going to change that. Like, look, you don't even have to, like, stop, like, you know, thinking of him. You don't have to stop following him. We understand that lots of people have lots of philosophers they follow. We understand he's a famous teacher and stuff like that. But you have to change. You can no longer worship him in your little Sunday gatherings. That's going to have to change, you know. And they're like, we're not going to change that. And he said, you don't understand. All we're asking you to do is stop doing your Sunday worship. Stop gathering together, celebrating the Eucharist, and talking about, you know, the risen Christ on the first day of the week, on Sunday. And the response from the kind of leader of their group was, we cannot live without Sunday. And that was the response. We cannot live without that central day of our lives. Everything leads up to and flows out of Sunday. Everything is trying to get us to that first day of the week when we come together, celebrate the Lord's Day, celebrate his death and rising, celebrate his gift of new life. We cannot live without Sunday. And man, what a condemnation, like, on our modern world. Like, you know, I mean, if you heard somebody today say, I can't live without Sunday, you're like, ah, I get it. NFL football. Yeah, I know, man. You know, the Packers or the Patriots or the Colts or whatever, the Broncos, you know. Like, but we don't think of it in terms of, I cannot live without Sunday. You know, if anything, Sunday is the day we catch up on stuff. Sunday is the day we do our shopping. It's we do our laundry. It's we do our homework. Sunday is the day that we, you know, sleep in late. Maybe we don't make it to Mass. Maybe we do, you know, whatever. Sunday is the day that we, you know, that we worry about everything else. And, you know, the entire idea that I cannot live without Sunday is really kind of lost on us. But that was the great, you know, the great call that they had, that the Sunday Eucharist, the Sunday celebration was really the center of these people's lives. It's a cool reflection, a cool challenge. And that's how Benedict kind of used it as a way to think about, you know, do we think in those terms of, like, this is what I'm moving towards, right? And all too often we're trying to, like, how do I fit my Sunday Mass into my schedule? You know, like, well, let's see. If we go to the 11 o'clock in Grand Island at the cathedral, then we can get out to this beforehand, but get back in time for that thing. You know, we kind of do it. And part of that is that the Catholic Church has been so successful. We have so many Mass times. We're so convenient. We've almost made a trap for ourselves. Like, when you lived in a little podunk town without a car in, like, the, you know, 1890s, well, guess what? You're going to church at 10. You know, like, it just, that's how life was, and you know, life revolved around it. So in some sense, we have almost out-convenienced ourselves out of, you know, making it the focus. And let me tell you, I'm as bad as anyone, so I'm not, this is not me pointing fingers, this is me just admitting as much as anyone. You know, it's like, oh, gotta get everything ready for the next week, oh, gotta do this, you know. Maybe take a nap, but that's more out of, you know, sometimes, I don't know, desperation or laziness than the idea of, like, oh, I'm resting with the Lord, you know. You know, so it's an interesting thing. I still have one more point on this. I got to figure out what it was. Crud. Any questions? If you have any questions, go for it and ask them. They might jog the memory. Dagnabbit. Now I just feel stupid. It was even something like on the back, like I was saying, like, oh, we can illustrate this on the back as well. It is not coming.
I still think you're really smart.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. What would it have been?
On your phone anymore? Like, did you write down
pre-? Nope. Nope. It literally came to me when I was over here drawing stuff, and I was like, oh, I'll have to throw that in there. And then it disappeared.
You'll think of it, like, tonight.
Oh, I'm going to text you guys all at 11:30, you know, with this topic. One thing, this is not related to it, but this, or not it, but I'll throw it in there. People oftentimes wonder, how do we get to Sunday, right? Because, of course, the Jews, their Sabbath day is this one, right? It's the seventh day of the week, because this, of course, is the first of the week. First, second, third, fourth, 5th, 6th, 7th. And even in the Roman calendar, when it counts these sort of things, it still, you know, calls this, you know, the 7th day of the week. And you see it even on traditional calendars. Now, I know our business calendars oftentimes switch things around because it wants to put 5 days and pack Saturday, Sunday together. But, you know, it still is the first day of the week. So what happened there? So, you know, Jesus dies the night before Sabbath. That's part of the reason why they had to take the bodies down and because it was going to be going to the Passover, right? He is in the tomb on the Sabbath. That's why the women come to the tomb early on the first day of the week. Because, of course, they cannot, under Jewish rules, go on the Saturday, the day of rest, the Sabbath, and go and do anything, you know, at the tomb. So they have to wait. So early on the first day of the week, they go, and that's when they see the angel and know that Jesus is risen and stuff like that. So this was still the Jewish day of rest. But along that path of the first and second centuries, as Christianity continued to preach, and especially as it's not so, this might be debated by certain scholars, but I would argue it's not so much that Christianity left Judaism, it's that Christianity kept going and Judaism intentionally pulled back. So it's almost more like they left us than we left them. St. Paul would say that, but St. Paul would also tick off a lot of rabbis today. But the idea that the Jews would be like, no, we don't think that's where history is going. We don't think that. We're going over here, and we're, and like we said the other day, that, you know, why did the Jews get expelled from Rome in the 40s AD? It's, we're told by Tacitus, it's this argument amongst the Jews over a certain Christos. You know, in fact, I think on 8, I think I might even have the quote. On the first page of this, I'm basically just going to choose to wrap up here. But if you look on down there, it says review, headline Romans. They write about the Christians, they argue with the Jews, and the worship of Christos. They worship Christos as if he was a god, right? And that's the thing. They debate. The Jews are debating about this certain Christos, and whether or not he's still alive. And so we see that the Jews are in that spot. So it's, as they pull away, as the synagogue gets more and more separated from the Christian church. Because the Christians are under persecution, the Jews are not. The Jews are still protected under Jewish law. Even when the Romans flatten the temple and take over Jerusalem, the Jews are still basically allowed their rights of religion. By the way, did you ever wonder why the Jews are allowed to keep their rules, keep their Jewish laws, and be part of the Roman Empire? There's a reason for it. Herod, the Herod that we, you know is trying to kill baby Jesus and stuff, that's Herod the Great. He's the first of the line of the Herods. There's other Herods after him. There's like four of them. But Herod the Great, the reason why he became king and the reason why, you know, his family's important and the reason why the Jews have the rights they did, Herod's dad saved Julius Caesar's butt when he was stuck in Egypt shack it up with Cleopatra. So Caesar goes off to Egypt when he's fighting the Roman civil war to become the sole leader of the Roman Republic. And while he's in Egypt, he meets like literally 15-year-old Cleopatra, heir to the throne of Alexander the Great and the Egyptians, and shacks up with her. They have a child. And while he's actually besieged in the town, and he has no way out, it's Herod's dad. I think, what's his name? I can't think of his name right now. But his dad, Herod's dad, comes down, saves Julius Caesar, and Julius Caesar cuts him a deal. He says, thank you, you saved my butt. I didn't have a chance. There was, you know, 100,000 Egyptians, and I had no way out. Thank you for saving me. Your family is now very special to me, and I'm going to protect you and your family and your religion. Because actually, Herod's dad himself is a convert to Judaism at the time. And so then later on, Herod is actually raised in the Roman court in Rome, and that's why he's able to basically get, basically the Romans say, yeah, we decided out of Thanksgiving, we're going to make you the king of the Jews. So Herod is interesting. He's only a half Jew, late convert, but he ends up being the king of the Jews through the most weird like set of circumstances. And that's why the Jews are allowed to practice their one religion with their one God, because actually of what Herod's dad did to save Julius Caesar's butt. I was hoping that in telling that story, I'd remember what I was going to say. I didn't. Yes?
How did or when did we allow like people to go to Mass on Saturday night, and that counts for
our... Good question. So actually, I need to finish up the Saturday part. Thank you. We'll make those two connect. So as the Jews slide away from Christianity, or the Christians slide away from the Jews, depending on how you look at it, eventually the Christians still celebrated that Sabbath, but the idea of the first day of the week taking on more and more importance to celebrate the day of the Lord, the Lord's Day, so you had kind of the Sabbath and the Lord's Day, and in time, the big Eucharist shifted from being here to being here. The biggest thing was the Lord's Day. And early on, the Christians saw the first day of the week as also the eighth day of the week, right? You know, it's kind of like, as you count it out, you know, we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So it's the idea of it's the first day of the week, but it's also the eighth day of the week, the new creation, like the starting it all over again. So that was really the shift there. So from that point on, Sunday was the Christians' day of worship, and they left behind Saturday. That continues as being very much the pattern, though in the late 1800s, there was this kind of rediscovery of earlier Christian worship and stuff. And in doing that, you had a lot of people saying, well, really, Saturday night should be part of it. And in fact, the monks had always kept that up. The monks, the breviary, the chubby little book of prayers that priests have to say and that monks pray in a bigger volume, that book of prayer always on, after sundown, on the seventh day already began practicing what the next day was. So for me, like, on Saturday night when I pray the evening prayers of the church, that actually is prayers for Sunday. And they're already talking about the readings for Sunday, the holy day of Sunday, or whatever, in that direction. So there was kind of already that. And then when the 20th century rolled in, there was this thought of, well, why couldn't we? We have other vigils. We have the Easter vigil. There's a vigil for Pentecost. There's a vigil for certain other big feasts, vigil of the Assumption. Why not have a vigil every Sunday? If every Sunday is a little Easter, could we do that? And it was seen as a thing of convenience, especially as, again, the modern world pressed on, and there was more people who had to work, you know, work on Sundays and other stuff like that, and it was seen as a thing of convenience. But it really only began in the 1960s. And actually, some dioceses resisted. I remember Cardinal Kroll, who was the Archbishop of Philadelphia, the Cardinal of Philadelphia, he resisted, I think, until like 1983, I want to say. All along, he argued, nope, we keep it on Sunday, otherwise you're going to lose some of the specialness of Sunday and stuff. And so he held on to that. The problem is Philadelphia sits directly below another diocese, Allentown, and directly across the river from New Jersey. And so you had all these people on the east end of Philadelphia who would go across the bridge, go to Mass in the evenings in Saturday of in New Jersey and come back over and then have their Sundays and stuff. And so Kroll, and that got Kroll mad. He was kind of a man of temper already, but it got him annoyed. But he didn't switch. He actually just kind of like kept on pushing his point. And then I think it was the 1983 Code of Canon Law that required that churches be able to choose their Mass schedules, and people throughout Philadelphia then chose and added the Saturday evening. But
so you can go Saturday evening or Sunday.
Yeah. So
it's not every day though.
What's that?
Can you go to Mass every day?
You can. Yep. We have a 7 o'clock Mass every day, and we do actually have a 6 o'clock on Friday night. But the two that count for your Sunday obligation are Saturday night and Sunday morning. And I just realized what my other thing was, but actually then I realized it probably actually goes on the discussion of the third commandment, so I won't go there. I would just waste my time.
So if you go to Mass like on a Tuesday morning, it doesn't count.
It doesn't count for Sunday. Now, what will sometimes happen is sometimes people will they'll miss Mass, and they know they're going to miss Mass. Like somebody will tell me, like, you know, Father, we've got this cruise that our kids bought us. We're going to go, and unfortunately, if it goes over the weekend, and oftentimes they try and get priests to go on the cruise so they can say Mass for the people on the cruise boat, but they weren't able to get one. What do we do? And the priest can give a dispensation. That's what it's called, basically saying that you're dispensed from having to make it that Sunday. But usually when you do that, you tend to try and give them, not quite a penance, because it's not confession, but to give them something else. So I usually suggest, can you try and, first of all, on that Sunday, make it worth it on the boat? You know, maybe read the scriptures or try and find Mass on TV or something like that. But also, I say, when you come back, can you go to a daily Mass sometime when you come back to the States? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, we can do that. So oftentimes, I'll ask people to kind of do that as their dispensation. It's not required, but it's a good thing to kind of, like, show good faith on that. Or you'll see other people doing that with, like, people in the hospital. You know, I always get the old people, you know, who are like, you know, oh, Father, we didn't make it to Mass last week. I'm like, yeah, there was 9 inches of snow. Like, but we watched it on TV and we read it in our little Magnificat. Like, I think you probably covered it. You probably did better than everybody else in the country, including people who were at Mass who fell asleep or distracted or whatever, you know.
Will you talk about the obligation? Because I'm not even really familiar.
Sure. Yeah, we'll talk about it when we get to the third commandment, because that'll be part of the stuff right there in the third commandment. So, yep. Yep.
And then our Mass before, that's the earliest it can be to count as.
Correct. In the Diocese of Lincoln, it's set. I'm not sure if every diocese has a set time, but in ours, 4 is the earliest we can do. Yep.
So, like, Catholic weddings have to be after 4 to be at.
Yeah. So actually, that's why around here, people are like, well, we're thinking about doing a wedding, but, you know, Mass has to be really early. I'm like, go for, like, a 5:30 wedding.
You know, it counts for Sunday. Your Catholic relatives will be just pumped, you know. And then you're not doing the 3 hours wasted time between the end of your 1 o'clock wedding and being able to get to the dinner and not, you know, be totally sloshed, you know.
Yeah, because that's ours was at 4 o'clock to count as Mass.
Uh-huh. Was that in Giltner then, I was assuming?
It was in Aurora.
Oh, okay, okay.
In Aurora, yeah.
Yep, okay. And so it was perfect. So you were able to be, and then probably all your Catholic family were so pumped.
And we both were born and raised Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
Besides of our family,
we're definitely
Catholic.
On the
so yeah, everybody yep. was really happy about that.
Yep. All the McMansley.
Yes.
Yep, you made them happy.
Yep.
Well, cool. Any questions? That was perfect. That wrapped us up to the end of that time, and now next time we'll just jump into number 8, and I'll be on time. I'm excited. All right.